Welcome again to Taking It Down, where we dispel our carefully crafted analysis on pop culture. This week, we'll talk briefly about the finale of Ted Lasso, get your hankies ready on that one, as well as the first three episodes of The Haunting of Bly Manor. After the break, we'll rattle off our favorite Halloween episodes of television shows throughout the years. Be sure to check the timestamps in the show notes so that you aren't spoiled by any of that. Before we get going, this is your last reminder of our first book club. We'll be covering The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones on October 27th. It's coming up quick. Joining me now are Mr. Bud Duncan, the grand leader of the Alabama Take, and a grand, man, you can go in some rough directions with that.
Yeah.
Had to pull that one back. And all the way from somewhere north of here, Mr. Donovan Reinwald.
Beautiful Connecticut.
It is beautiful, y'all. The leaves are turning, the pumpkins are out, crisp apples, the scent of wood smoke in the air. That's because we had a forest fire.
Oh, God.
I was going to say no more. Maybe I should have said say no more because everything was picturesque until that last part.
That's thinking about the favorite Halloween episodes, you talking about crisp apples. Remember that Simpsons episode where they Flanders has the season pass to the orchard thing, and it's apple cider versus apple juice, and he has all these rhymes. Never mind.
It's a classic. Yes. Yeah.
So we're gonna end up back there, I have a feeling, in the second half of the show.
Yes. I've got my Simpsons episode locked and loaded. I've got two picks for best.
Let's sweep a little news out of the way before we do anything. So we always check in with COVID. It's Coach Saban.
I'll tell you where COVID wasn't.
Do tell.
In Saban?
Apparently not.
Seems that way.
But I tell you where it is now. Stan Mullen. If you would have made me guess which SEC coach would get it first, I wouldn't have said Saban, but I would have said Stan. Is it Stan Mullen? What is his name?
Dan
Mullen. Is that really?
We've called him Stan Mullins for so long that I can't. When I say it out loud, I'm like, I know this is wrong, but I don't know what's right either.
I honestly have had to look it up before sending a text message about him to somebody that wouldn't get the joke.
It was kind of great, right? With him being like, we only lost because there weren't enough fans. Pack them in there. And then the hilarious backpedaling he had to do about 2 days later. when I said packing in there, I meant in the biblical sense.
Oh, man. Just full karma arc in 1 week for him.
In the last 3 weeks, just over the whole news of COVID, it seems. And it is surging. It's surging in our state, in Alabama. It's surging in spots across the nation. It's kind of worrisome.
It's surging in my town right now. So, you know, everyone wash your hands and wear a mask. And
yeah, wash your hands and wear a mask and stay 6 feet away from people when you can. I mean, you just can't say that enough, I guess.
If you told me that the first SEC coach to get it was going to be Lane Kiffin or Mike Leach, I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, Lane would have gotten it sneaking around, probably sneaking around the Grove, you know, like the Hamburglar or something. And Mike Leach is just really damn weird. So, like, who knows? Yeah, I got COVID, but don't worry. I cut it off a cat.
I got a feeling that Mike Leach is not a mask guy. I just have a feeling.
He's
doing it because it's the rules, but he's not philosophically bought in.
His heart is not in it.
Not in a hateful way, just in a weird way. Just like
in a weird way, yeah.
I think him at Washington State made sense because there's a lot of preppers kind of out in that corner of the world, and I think he probably fit right in.
I don't disagree with that.
Now, Donovan, let me ask you this.
Absolutely.
Did you we tape on Sundays? Did you stay up and finish the Bama Georgia game last night?
I did. Yep.
As out there on the Eastern time zone. What is wrong with CBS? It starts here. We need to run this up the flagpole. Maybe Doug Jones can squeak it in before the inevitable. It needs to be outlawed.
You know what we did?
A night game on CBS.
You know what we did to try and make it more palatable was we actually started because, you know, it's like, it starts today. Well, it's really more like 8:15. So we started at 9 to try and just roll through some of the commercials. We caught up. We were live by halftime.
Oh, I'm sure.
We could have, I'm sure. Like, with an hour head start on them. It was ridiculous. Yeah, it ought to be.
CBS never misses an opportunity to cut to a commercial.
They cut to a commercial to advertise the worst programming on television. Like every time they break in and say, be sure to catch whatever this week. It's like,
your heart wasn't cheered by young Sheldon. He's young. No. And he's Sheldon.
Can I admit something to you guys and to our listeners?
You kind of like young Sheldon?
Nope. But I DVR 60 Minutes and I watch it if the segments are good.
That's not bad.
There's nothing wrong with 60 Minutes.
That's not bad.
It's still a good quality news source, I think.
When that clock starts ticking and they're, I'm like, oh yeah, okay.
It's something to
when
it.
When the clock starts ticking, it's like, oh shit, they only have 60 minutes. And then it's over.
For years and years, they were the only show on television that didn't have a theme song. So good. There's that's a bit good. Of trivia. Used to be
that's
a bit.
That's pretty good.
I wanted to talk, just quick response. No, we're not going to dive into this. Hillbilly Elegy, the movie trailer. You know, do you guys care? Did you see it?
I care about it exactly as much as I care about other fine quality Ron Howard films. Not at all.
This is a work that the whole J.D. Vance thing and now this that I don't really know a ton about other than people that I trust, especially people maybe with more skin in the game on that part of the country being well represented in literature and film and television. Really hate the guy and they hate the idea of this movie. And I just saw takedown after takedown. And so I was like, you know what? I trust enough of you guys. This is maybe not for me. Although I will say, I mean, Ron Howard, there are some names attached to it that in different circumstances, I may pull it up, but I'm probably not into it.
Here's the thing. It's got Glenn Close, Amy Adams and Ron Howard directing. And there's on paper, there's nothing wrong with it except for the title and the book it was based off of, this memoir. It's going to be hard to watch because J.D. Vance is such a dick. But I don't know. I was actually kind of mentally wrestling with this for a couple of minutes just after the trailer released and I watched it. And I saw some of these responses you're talking about online. It's a different beast, isn't it? Because you have the possibility of some really great acting. You got the possibility of taking a story and dramatizing it and making it interesting. But at the same time, you got... It's Hillbilly Elegy and
the baggage.
It's just too. I don't know if I can drop the baggage on this one. That's a good conversation to have maybe in the future for this show. Is when can you drop the baggage of what comes with the art and just enjoy the art? And I don't know that I can with this one. Although it does, it looked okay. It looked like Oscar bait, and sometimes I'm definitely the fish for that bait. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, and Amy Adams has been. I mean, I think she's always been great, but has been on a hot streak over the last few years, I think. So there's no reason to believe that it won't be compelling, but I don't know. It just seems... I'm a wait and see on this one.
Same.
Yeah, I understand. Me too, but I do, I'm like Adam. I do trust those people who know a lot more about J.D. Vance and what... And the more I read about that guy, the more of a utter dick he is. I'm not so sure if this guy isn't going to try to make a play for politics in a few years, so we're really going to get exposed to how much of a piece of shit he probably is.
I'd actually be surprised if he didn't.
For real. Let's shift into something even better. More warm-hearted. The Ted Lasso finale, which I know Adam and I have. Yeah. I really want to get your thoughts, Adam, because you mentioned online on your Twitter feed, and you even said to me that it made you tear up. It didn't have that effect on me, but I don't disagree with how it could.
Well, I guess we should spoiler warn at this point. We'll get into the details of the episode, kind of the points that got me.
You'd have to spoil it to talk about why it touched you so.
I guess I could do some broad strokes, but...
There we go.
Thank you. I'll sidebar while we're on that topic. The Little America recommendation was excellent. That was so good. Cool. So we flew through those episodes.
Yeah, and they're breezy, and they feel quite adjacent to the same vibe Ted Lasso has, I think.
It's a funny, this is an odd bridge to say exist, but if there was a bridge between Immigration Nation and Ted Lasso, somehow Little America is it.
That's it.
Because there's heartbreak and there's frustration in it. And even when the stories end, you know, air quotes, happy, it's it can sometimes be a bit hollow.
Yeah, they're not a bummer.
Right. I will admit that I am a sucker for, I don't know if this takes away my, like, you know, capital S serious brain energy of like reading books and watching movies and all this kind of stuff, like, you know, important stuff, so to speak. But sports movies, man, they can get me at the right time, because I think it's when they're really done well, they find a way to disarm you, because you're thinking, well, this is ultimately like sports could just not exist and we'd be fine, of course. But, well, there could be an argument made against that, but it turns into a just an expression of, when it's done well in art, of the human spirit, right? And even if the goal is just to win a game or whatever it is, like, it just, it takes on way more meaning. And I think especially with Ted Lasso, the character Ted Lasso was just so irrepressibly optimistic and sunny. And we kind of touched on, you know, there were darker moments he's wrestling with. He's not naive, I don't think, in his approach to that. But the two things that really got me were when Roy is injured and is pretty sure that this is it. He's not gonna play again. That one got me pretty good. And then the moment when the dream has been realized only to be taken away, and they play You'll Never Walk Alone, which is a pretty, as Blaine, now that you're a big soccer guy, you will discover that You'll Never Walk Alone is, I joke that the only thing that really kept me from tears is this is like the unofficial anthem of Liverpool. And I just despise Liverpool Football Club. So it didn't really get to fully flesh out between that and the fact that the Mumford guy sang it. So it's this kind of moving piano version of it. But that song has a lot of significance in English soccer because of the famous incident that happened with Liverpool supporters. Where did you ever see the 30 for 30 on that? Where there was, you know, back in the day, we're really getting in the weeds here, but back in the day, they kind of did general admission in part of the stadium. And there would frequently be, if everybody pushes in one direction, people could be crushed to death and killed. And there was this one particularly tragic day where, I mean, just, do you remember the, it's like 106?
Yeah. What was,
does that sound right?
It sounds right.
I feel bad that I don't know the exact number, but anyway, that became kind of like a Liverpool, You'll Never Walk Alone. And so it has this like heavy emotional resonance. And I guess all of the things that happen across the course of the season, I'm sure it has a lot to do with the season of life that we're all in because of 2020, and you want goodness to be confirmed and you want blah, blah, blah. But I don't know, that song at the end and the way they all kind of reacted to that moment, I just found it all very moving. I mean, and I, again, admit that you have to be a bit of a sucker for a sports flick to let that happen. But I was there. I was in it. I did not when we started the show, people were like, oh, it's fun. It's good. I did not expect for it to finish there.
Okay, so the song was lost on me. Maybe it would have had a more resonance if I'd known the history of the song.
I texted my buddy who's a Liverpool fan, and I said, did you just cry your eyes out at the end? Because it's meant a lot to him, and he even, I think, Liverpool soccer, and it feels weird to say from this far away, but at different hard points in his life, that song has meant a lot. He was like, oh, yeah.
It was 96 people killed. 766 people injured.
Yeah. What year was that?
1989.
I didn't know that. So, okay, that does make, that clicks, that tracks.
Yeah, it was a good combination of soccer history and culture and kind of the Ted Lasso thing. And you still had his, I'll use the word again, irrepressible optimism and belief in his fellow man when he, you know, gives Jamie the note at the end. And, you know, even, it's like a Shakespearean arc in a way that he sets up his own demise through goodwill instead of ill. I don't know. I thought it was great. What was any questions that you had last week? Do you feel like it kind of resolved over the rest of the season that you watched? Kind of like, is he going to be more fleshed out? Does it have the gravity maybe that it needs to have?
I think it was so well done, and it did answer any lingering thoughts I had. It resolved everything I wanted it to, and knowing that it's got a second season coming is just fantastic. I'm so excited. I sped through this show like I haven't sped through a show in probably about a year, maybe.
Yeah.
I would watch two or three episodes a day, which is unlike me. I usually like to dole out episodes one a night at the most. or one every other night or something like that. But I ate this one up, man, and it was it's probably my most recommended show because there are so many different kinds of people who would like this. It's not just a niche type of show. I know when I tell people that it's heavily involved with soccer world, you know, they kind of look at me funny, but it's about as much it's as much about soccer as it is anything else, really.
I mean, right. I mean, there's long sections of the show where they don't even show a soccer ball or a pitch or anything like that.
In fact, I don't know that I would recommend it to a huge soccer fan because there's just so little soccer going on.
Right. And you kind of have to suspend some disbelief at moments. And
yep.
Like when they play Manchester City at the end, I was angry that Aguero was not wearing the number 10 shirt, things like that. Could have used some. Yeah. Maybe next season. Maybe it's been so well received, there'll be some high profile. I don't know. Maybe that would ruin it. I kind of liked it being in this fictional cocoon, you know.
And some other brief thoughts we're going to throw out, and we might come back to in a few weeks after we've watched them all. But Donovan and I have been watching The Haunting of Bly Manor. I think I'm 3 episodes deep. Donovan, right. What about you?
No, I finished it.
No way.
Yeah.
Crushed it.
Wow. Okay, well, speak to me generally. Good, bad, mediocre? What did you think?
I'm going to give it thumbs up, but a qualified thumbs up. I think the show made a big stumble kind of near the end.
So I was tracking the ghosts in the background. Yeah. This show is notorious for putting ghosts in the background and not being blatant about where they are. They're just there.
There's not
and
as
you
many,
see them, you see them.
I've seen a couple. Did you see the soldier?
Yes. 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 Yeah. I've seen a few. And vulture.com is a great website. I admire their work, but they have a specific article that episode by episode tells you where to look and the timestamps to look. And I always go back and read those once I finish an episode. That's been a lot of fun to do. And, you know, even if the show isn't like some great quality Mad Men, Sopranos type show, there is this very October fun just to watch it and see if you can see a ghost in the background. And sometimes the plot gets a little slow for me with these two shows. They did The Haunting of Hill House and this one, and it has slow moments, but in those slow moments, I'll catch myself looking into the corner of the screen to see if there's anyone there. And sometimes there is.
That's the biggest innovation, I think, of these shows. Cause like you have the slow character building moments and they never let you forget that it's part of this, you know, haunting. I'll say my watching this has kind of confirmed what I said about Mike Flanagan and Hill House, where he's not revolutionizing the horror genre or anything like that. But a lot of times I think he does very well. I've kind of seen that before, but this is a new twist on it, or you're just doing it really well. It's kind of like for something that I like enjoyed and wanted to watch, this kind of makes it sound like I'm damning it with faint praise. But I really do think, especially if you kind of like horror, scary stuff, there are like flashes of brilliance. Like the whole thing isn't brilliant, but there are moments in it where it's like, wow, that was really good.
Yeah. And it kind of makes up for the down.
Absolutely.
This show has this, The Haunting of Bly Manor and The Haunting of Hill House has this effect on me. It doesn't scare me in the moment. I think it did you.
Bly Manor, not so much. Hill House, there was the jump scare. Whenever I refer to this, everyone knows what I'm talking about. It scared me so bad that I hit my wife without realizing it. So she made me, she was recovering from getting her wisdom teeth out. So she made me sit across the room when we were watching it so that there couldn't be any accidents.
Wise woman. But it doesn't have that effect on me. What it does for me is when I am the last one up in the house at night and I'm walking through the house, turning out the lights.
Oh, hell yeah.
I always think, okay, is there going to be something standing in the corner? Because I've spent an hour looking at watching a show and looking for things in the corner, and now I'm doing it in real life. So
you know,
it gives me the creepy feeling after, and I always like that.
You know what ruined me for that is when my bathroom has a window that's right at eye level. So if I'm in the middle of the night and I have to pee, I'm looking right out the window. You can't see anything. And like the in Salem's Lot, there's a bit, right, where the the kid that's is at the window. That's the
scariest thing I think, like, I've ever seen.
Yeah. I'm just like, well, if I go, this is how I go.
That Salem's Lot is not so good of a rendition of a Stephen King book, but geez, those scenes with the kids floating outside the window, that's enough to traumatize you.
The rest of it's not great. That part stuck.
For real. All right, guys, I think we all watched The Trial of the Chicago 7. Netflix released this on Friday. It's pretty recent. It's a new movie written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. It's based on the true story of the anti-war protesters at the 1968 Democratic National Convention, specifically those who were arrested for conspiracy to start a riot across state lines. And they were charged with like one other thing, if I'm not mistaken. But I was pretty familiar with the 68 Democratic National Convention. I've seen the news footage and everything. We're talking about a great cast here from Sacha Baron Cohen, Eddie Redmayne, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Frank Langella, and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who was in Watchmen and is coming to the new Candyman, which will be out next year, I think. But he played the leader of the Black Panther Party, Bobby Seale, which I was familiar with that name as well. Donovan, I'm going to start with you.
Here I am.
And you told us you're not a Sorkin guy. Why is that?
I find, and this... So let me go out and say that I enjoyed watching this movie. It was zippy. It moved along just fast and fine. But also it did nothing to like disabuse me of my notion of Sorkin's movie. You know, it's like he's got the fast talking dialogue. You know, sometimes it's more like kind of what sunk Studio 60, right? It's more clever than it actually is funny. Mm. He's the smartest guy in the room, and he wants you to know it. And characters can be a little self-righteous, right? Like I think he's very impressed with his own writing, and he is a good writer. I don't want to, like, I can't write a movie like Aaron Sorkin can, but like, you'll notice that towards the end, whenever he had his character, especially when he had his characters want to make a speech, all of a sudden the judge stopped interrupting and they had long stretches where they could
very
talk
convenient.
And The ending, I was laughing at the various spoilers, everyone, because I'm going to talk about the end of the movie, although is it a spoiler if you can Google it?
That's good. Yeah, like, that's a question I was going to bring up. But
you know, it happened, but it really made me laugh. The ending made me laugh because it felt like a parody of a Sorkin movie as the uplifting music starts. The noble hero starts reading, "Order, sir! I will have order!" You know, cheering. It felt, I was like, if you were trying to like savagely burn Sorkin, you couldn't do a better job than he just did to himself. On the other hand, if I may quote from Brian Tallarico's review, yeah. "I never would have guessed how much I would enjoy a hippie buddy comedy starring Sacha Baron Cohen and Jeremy Strong." I stand by that assertion.
That's a pretty strong statement. Adam, give me your overall thoughts before we start picking it apart.
I thought it was really good. I'm with Donovan that the Sorkin shtick can become tiresome. You kind of know when he's, I'm just going to parrot what you said, basically, if I keep going. You know when he's doing his thing, he's a clever guy. That sometimes that gets him into trouble, I think. But also he wrote The Social Network, and it's, you know, people argue that's one of the best movies of the 2010s, and I can't really argue against it. So I thought that the combination, you know, Blaine, you said that you are familiar with all of the news footage and kind of the story, and I think probably all of us are to some degree. But, you know, I'd seen it all. I thought the way that they wove all of the historical stuff and the recreations together, and even how the narrative was told, jumping from person to person, I thought all of that was really clever. I thought that the courtroom stuff was good. I don't know. I'm kind of a sucker for a movie that just stays moving forward. You know, they were in that courtroom a lot. And if you can achieve that and like really keep me kind of fully engaged and not looking at my phone, I think that's a pretty good movie.
Yeah, that was when I was watching it, the word that kept popping into my head was deft.
Yeah.
D-E-F-T, yeah. Not deaf. To describe his directing, because like he keeps it pretty zippy. I mean, I was engaged.
Yeah, there are movies where like, we sat down with dinner, and I sat there with an empty, dirty plate on my lap for like an hour and a half before I realized that it had gone by. And, you know, there are other movies where it's like 35 minutes in, and I'm like, hey, I'm going to go put this plate away, and it feels like you've been watching for an hour already.
Absolutely.
And that's a goofy way to say if a movie's good or not, but at the same time, like, for what something that comes out on a Friday night on Netflix, it scratched that itch, and it also made me think a little bit, or gave me new insight, or at least jumping off points into, like, I have Wikipedia tabs open on almost every character from it. You know, like, it gave me new insight, I guess.
I would pause the movie and look up different things, and me pausing it's probably a pretty good sign, because any other movie that I think is going slowly, I would maybe not pause it and just try to skim whatever it is and try to double screen it. But this one, I wanted to hear everything, and you guys are stealing my thoughts here, but the movie starts with a historical montage, and if you want to hook me, you give me a historical montage about the 60s and I will watch your movie.
As a child of people who grew up in media created by boomers, Forrest Gump has taught me that I will enjoy anything that starts with a little good historical inclusion or reenactment.
I thought the way it started was great, but haven't we seen enough montages of the 60s at this point?
Not this guy has not.
You're down for more. You're ready for more.
you were Aaron Sorkin.
And you guys commented on Sorkin in general, and I'll throw in my two cents. I like him quite a bit. I like The Newsroom up until I found a horrible thing like this happens. You find out that the show's canceled before you're finished watching it, and you just don't even want to finish watching it. That happened to me with Newsroom, but I did enjoy it. And I like the fast-paced dialogue. I like the bit of, you know, I'm the smartest guy in the room a little. I guess because it's so zippy that I don't have time to stop and think that that's what he's doing. But let's get into the movie some.
Every time he does the classics walk and talk. Mm-hmm. And every time I think that, there's a 30 Rock episode that Aaron Sorkin's in, and Liz asks Kenneth, can you walk and talk? And he's like, well, usually Miss Lemon, but now you got me thinking about it. All I can think about every time I see something that he does.
So we'll talk about some of the casting. Sure, Sacha Baron Cohen as Abbie Kaufman was going to catch my eye. But when I saw John Carroll Lynch was in it, my heart started pumping for just joy. They didn't get to use him quite enough. If you know him, he's the older bald guy who was arrested, the father figure, I suppose you could say. And that, if you've ever seen him in anything, he is truly an excellent actor. He's really good when he's asked to show a caring side, and he didn't get quite to do that enough in this film.
Although when he did it, I thought it was really strong. Like when he's playing kind of like the straight man of the situation, trying to keep it on the rails, like in lesser hands, that wouldn't have been as affecting, but it was, I don't know, his physical presence and ability to do that, I thought were really good.
He's great because he maybe gets like 4 minutes in Fargo as Norm Gunderson. Mm-hmm. And he just instantly makes an impression. He's awesome.
Well, I know this is an odd connection, but he is in one episode of The Walking Dead. And I know a lot of people are like, fuck that show. But it is by hands down their best episode. And he's only in the one episode. He's only in the one episode. And I've watched it. It's the only episode I think I've purposely watched two times in a row because I was so enthralled by his performance. It almost brought me to tears. It was just a moving performance, and I thought, man, that guy's so good. He's in Zodiac. Have you seen Zodiac?
Yeah. He's in The Americans too. He's pretty good.
He's in what?
He's got like a stretch where he's in The Americans.
Yes, he is. That's right.
He's got a couple episodes that he's in. He's
and
good.
Another guy who's really scratching that itch for me, to borrow Adam's phrase from earlier, is Mark Rylance. He was unrecognizable
to me.
When I saw him on screen, I kept thinking, who is this guy? This seems like a big role for somebody I don't really know. But it turns out it was Mark Rylance, who is a fantastic British actor.
Mark Rylance was awesome in this movie, but really awesome. But I feel like Sorkin must be really good with actors because he was getting great. You know, everyone kind of gets a moment in the sun. And I felt like everyone, like there was something fun in almost every performance.
I agree.
Everyone seemed like they were enjoying themselves. Also, Frank Langella as the judge, I thought he was great.
I mean, yeah, he played a truly hateable character. Yeah,
you he just really wanted did. To strangle him. Also an alumnus of the Americans.
That's very true. Aaron Sorkin directed this, which is not... He's only done, what, two films as a director, but he's, of course, written everything.
Yeah.
A lot of those lines, speaking of his writing, a lot of those lines just really made my ears perk up because they sound exactly like news quotes or tidbits from the news today. It's hard to imagine that the U.S. was as divided as it is today, but it did, you know?
You like the bit where he's like, well, the attorney general is not the president's lawyer.
Yes, I did. Did you guys, we're getting a little off script here, but did some of that division go away in the 70s, 80s, and 90s and then kind of boiled back up again?
I kept thinking about that in this. Like I read actually Friday that the five biggest mass protest movements in American history have all happened during the Trump administration. And when you think about...
I saw that too, yeah.
When you think about like what was happening in the 60s and at other moments in American history, I mean, there's more people now. We have the ability to organize faster thanks to things like Twitter and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you think about these legendary moments like the Chicago riot here, what they clearly outline as a police riot. And it's like, well... You clearly see why Sorkin chose to do this now. I mean, obviously, he didn't decide to do it in June when the 2020 madness started, but boy, did it. You know, sometimes I wonder if these directors, after they've already committed to, you know, he's probably deep into editing when all of that starts going down, if he's kind of thinking like, well, I don't think any of them would think, well, good timing for me, but kind of at the same time, like, this is really going to ring true.
Because I think this has been a like passion project for him, right? Like he's been working, he's had this in some form or another for years and years, and it may just be, you know, too, that kind of like the money fell into place now.
The background of the story is, or the background of the movie getting made was he began writing it in 2008.
Wow,
so he's had it 12 years at least.
It'd be interesting to ask him if you start writing something at the beginning of the Obama administration and it's like probably the most optimistic outside of the recession as that starts to kind of conclude. It's a time of optimism relative to the last 10 years. I wonder how much his writing changed as things evolved. You know, like sometimes you get the impression that like 60s period pieces are kind of a victory lap. In a way, like, yeah. Especially in the 90s, mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you remember when racism was a problem? Good thing we saw that in this movie or whatever it is. I don't know. Just it, like we've said, it just ramped up so much its relevance to today.
I thought that Sorkin made great choices. He chose not to show the riots until much later. You're pretty much in the courtroom from scene one.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he does the classic, here's what happened kind of thing as the trial goes on. I thought that was a good choice that worked here. And you didn't really get to see the actual riot until later in the movie, in the last act.
Yeah, and again, I thought the way that was told was really clever. That, you know, part of the job of the prosecution, of course, was to say that these people were doing something collectively, and the way that the story of the riot was recounted kind of proves their point, that each of them had a different view, even though they were in the same place at the same time. Oftentimes it almost had like a very like modernist kind of, although everybody we assume is a reliable narrator, but the kind of all the different ways of looking at it and telling the story.
Yeah, we're not full Rashomon here.
No, I thought that the way that information was unveiled was clever.
Sometimes it worked for me. Sometimes it kind of, especially when they kept cutting back to Abbie Hoffman's, when Sorkin kept cutting back to Abbie Hoffman, as much as I enjoyed Hoffman in the Borat shirt, it did slow it down a little bit for me.
The college tour thing that he was on?
Yeah, I was like, wow, he kept going back to that specifically as a device. And it's like, I think, Adam, I think you're right that it kind of underscores like especially the differences between, say, the Yippies and the SDS or whatever. But I was also like, oh, okay, we're back here.
Right. You know, Abbie Hoffman kind of worked as the character who would explain the themes. And you're right. I think for me, the only time that became a little too ham-fisted was the last one, that where he sort of connected class being part of the police brutality and the riots, and there were some connections being made. That part almost didn't work for me, but I did end up appreciating it because I could have made those connections myself, but you know, it was fun.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes Sorkin is gonna, like, he's gonna make sure you know what he means. Right. So it's like when they do put Abbie on the stand, right. And he's like, well, I'm sorry, I've never been on trial for my thoughts before. Trying to do
right,
Boston,
right. So. And that
was a great line, but
it was,
right.
But it was, it also failed. Just like, you know, there's the great bit in Arrested Development where, you know, Arrested Development, hey, that's the name of our show. Like, I always think of that. Like, right. You know what I mean? Like, hey, that's the name of our show.
Yeah. I think that moment and kind of, Blaine, I assume you're talking about the confrontation between Hoffman and Hayden, the kind of the ideological clash there of SDS versus the Yippies, voting versus social change. I think some of that was a little heavy-handed. The other thing that was striking was we talked about how hateable almost everyone in the establishment, you know, again, air quotes, establishment, was from the judge to, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt did a really nice job, I thought, playing the conflicted prosecutor. But they all had these hateable moments, and it was... I'm sure he has court records that he poured over to write this stuff. So maybe they were as difficult and obstinate as it made it sound. And I'm sure it was an uphill battle, but they really, especially in the first hour, you knew that the government were not the good guys.
And I really liked how Sorkin did, whether, you know, it was 100% accurate or not, really didn't matter, because it was a piece of art telling you something grander than what's on screen. But I love that he shows that a riot or the disruption of peace sometimes starts with people that are with you but aren't listening to you or truly a part of your movement.
Oh yeah.
Like when someone throws a glass at the police, glass bottle, and the character of John Carroll Lynch turns around and is like, no, don't do that. Who's doing that? Stop that. You know, that's not our mission here. And that really fits with the parochial view of people online saying that, well, if you're going to protest, you better not riot or you better not burn something down, you know.
Getting any large group of people, you know, if you go to one of these protests that happened over the summer, I'm sure that everyone experienced something similar, whether it's chanting or marching or whatever it is. It has a feeling that, you know, I mean, I'm sure if you did like a brain scan, part of it is the same thing that makes you root harder for your football team when you're in the crowd than if you're alone. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like it taps into something that, you know, all bets are off when, especially, you know, I thought this summer, like this, we're so divided, but we're also, there's not a draft happening on top of this that is truly life or death and is so reflective of socioeconomic problems. Like we have a whole set of issues to deal with in 2020, but so for people who this is life and death, being out in the street like that, I have sympathy for how something could go south quickly.
Yeah, one thing, and I think we could actually have more of this, was the Bobby Seale character kind of saying, do you understand how saying fuck you to dad is different than a rope over a tree? Which may not be the most elegant way to put it.
You know,
Sorkin can be a little on the nose, but I thought, like, this is pretty interesting. And actually, I didn't really know anything about it, but I'd just been talking because I'm involved in the Episcopal Church in Connecticut, and we've been working on like racial justice initiatives, stuff like that. And I was talking with folks about their experience living in New Haven through the Black Panther kind of trials and all that kind of, and it was very like very content, you know, just very contentious, and you know, there was violence and it's been really kind of neat to, you know, sometimes you learn a little more about things that you really should know about.
There, ever since I've been a kid, these 60s recreations have always had this romanticism to them. I would have thoughts like, if I was there, I would have protested. Yeah. I would have been one of the good guys. But the real thing is, much like 2020, it's scarier than that. Adam, you've been a part of a few protests, and you've had moments where you thought, this could get ugly.
Yeah, I'm protesting Confederate relics in what's basically rural Alabama. You have people that are armed that are against what's happening. And, you know, we saw people drive by that almost lose control of their vehicle. They're hanging out the window screaming at us because it just makes them so angry. And when you, unfortunately, that means your protest is effective. You know what I mean? Like, it, you are touching on something, not that you go out to agitate necessarily, but if that's how you react to someone opposing something, then whatever they're opposing is probably worth opposing. You know what I mean? Like, if you kind of want to follow that emotional logic. Yeah, it is frightening. And I thought, I've seen this a lot this summer, that, you know, especially for people who grew up in the 80s and 90s in suburbia, where there wasn't, especially in the 90s, really that much bad happening. You know, like, so you kind of imagine, like, well, if we were at a, if this was World War II and I was in Germany, how would I react? If this was the Civil Rights Movement and I was in Alabama, how would I react? I think the answer to that question is, what did you do in the summer of 2020?
Do you realize that you're trying to destroy history, though, Adam?
I do.
Understand that?
I can't. Yeah. I mean,
just checking.
Speak to your right. I think we all are like, yeah, if I would have been there, you know, the movies kind of portray these protesters now as like, okay, they're unequivocally the good guys. But then if you look back, you know, you can go to your public library, and if you've got a decent newspaper database like Redex, you can do a search for letters to the editor after the Kent State shootings, when the National Guard killed those, a bunch of letters. That's what they get. If they're not going to be in school, I think they should be, you know, these long haired hippies out there barefoot, they deserve to be, you know, we didn't shoot enough of them. You know,
the New York Times published a thing where they showed numbers asking, what do you think about athletes kneeling during the national anthem? And it was, do you think it makes a difference? And they had results on that. Are you for it or against it? Blah, blah, blah. And then they showed the exact same answers to the questions, or to the same questions about, like, lunch counter sit-ins and freedom rides. And it's the exact same breakdown. Like, we change and evolve. And obviously, we're not segregated on paper anymore. So it's not quite the same thing. And people are able to say, well, you know, this is different times. But I mean, really, the breakdown is the same.
In Connecticut, the big issue right now is zoning. And the all the towns get to do their zoning individually, which means a lot of towns can block affordable housing, which de facto keeps things segregated. So, you know, it's very present. It's very with us.
It is. And one thing, to kind of circle all the way back to what you were saying about, we now think of them as heroes. I was definitely struck while watching, thinking, you know, we do know what happens to, I mean, Tom Hayden gets to go on and be like have a career as a politician. But at the time, these were people risking, they could have just gone to jail for 10 years and then be spit back out into a society that had moved on and didn't care. They could have lost. I don't know. These things go through your head where, like, I've been in situations like, am I going to get arrested today? This could be interesting. And you think that, you know, you don't know. I don't know what 10 years from now looks like. So it's odd. And it deepens your admiration. This coming out now, again, we say, well, we would have been right there with them. Well, that's not true. Like, I have had my resolve tested, I feel like, as we all have. And I don't know. I definitely took that away from this. So just an admiration for what people are capable of, even if it is Sorkined up a little bit.
I think that's a good summation. This movie had a feel of a play in a very good way. It was one of the more rhythmic movies I'd seen, and I think it worked. It was overall really good.
If you're gonna make a courtroom drama, you might as well get Aaron Sorkin to make it, right? Yeah. What else are you doing?
There you go. Well, let's take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about some of the best or our favorite Halloween episodes from television. Hey people, just a mid-show pause to ask you to support the site if you want and if you can. You can do so by heading over to buymeacoffee.com/thealabamatake, where you can make a donation of any amount. You can also find that link on the Alabama Take website by clicking on Shop. If you would like to write for the Alabama Take or have your own podcast under our banner with help from us, we welcome those things. Send us an email or a message online. With all that out of the way, we're going to talk some Halloween episodes from television. So let's talk about our favorite Halloween episodes of TV. It's just a little background. Halloween episodes have always been my favorite. Halloween's one of my favorite times of year. We've talked about those aspects of our opinions before. For some reason, I recall a lot of Home Improvement episodes that had Halloween themes. You know,
oddly, me too.
I even vaguely remember an episode or two of The Dukes of Hazzard having a Halloween spooky theme. Roseanne always did it, I think, every single year. I even recall My So-Called Life having a Halloween episode, but I might be wrong about that. So what makes a good Halloween episode of television for you?
I was watching old Treehouse of Horror and realized, you know, basically like, oh, these are great. Why are they great? Because they're Simpsons episodes that just happen to be Halloween themed. And I think that kind of cuts across the board, right? If the joke can't be it's Halloween, the joke has to be, you know, it has to be a Halloween episode of the show that you were watching.
I feel like there's maybe a few ways shows go about it, right? Like The Simpsons and others use it as an excuse to indulge weirdness from the writers, right? Like they still get to make Simpsons jokes and use the characters, but they also get to come up with these just insane circumstances that even in the Simpsons world doesn't usually get to exist. And then there's like the more like just lean into the season, the autumnal kind of like wistful melancholy thing. I feel like those are the two that I dig.
You guys hit it, I think. If you like the show already, then what you get is to see these characters in costume. That's always fun. You know, you may not go and dress up for Halloween yourself, but even seeing people dressed in like a skeleton costume or as their favorite movie character, it's fun to me.
It is.
I will get us going, and I will mention, I'm going to go with my first choice for Halloween episode was from Community. I think that's the most good one. Epidemiology is the name of it. It's if you haven't seen it, it's a zombie breaks out at the community college. I think this has one of my most repeated lines I've ever heard from television, which is where he says, "You son of a bitch, I thought you were dead."
I'm also a big fan of nobody can guess that, you know, Shirley's Miss Piggy, and nobody can guess what ice skater Senor Chang went as. So he keeps going, you know, variations of, "You've just been proven racist by the racist prover." something I think about a lot.
What they did with this episode is they had a Halloween party there that was going on at the community college, and they upped the stakes by having this fake zombie outbreak. And it just puts those characters in a heightened unreality, I suppose. And, you know, it just became very funny. And that was when the show was really peaking anyway. I think that's season two's one of the early episodes in season two, and I felt as though they were hitting all their marks around that time.
Speaking of fun costumes for that one, you know, that they always were good with the costumes, because I think Troy is like the loader from Aliens. You know, that's one of the
oh yeah,
one of the costumes. You know, like it ends up being a plot point.
That's so good. Yeah. Yes.
There's some fun costumes.
I mean, I think the cartoons are kind of given the longest leash because you can really jump in. Obviously, Treehouse of Horror being the leader of the pack on that. But talking about funny costumes and seeing characters in funny costumes, an early one, I'm going to have a few King of the Hill entries.
Absolutely.
But the Halloween is the 16th episode of King of the Hill, and It is like one of the most 90s culture war pieces of, you could study this in American studies and like try to figure out, let's see, this came out in 1997. So like dead center of me going to fall festivals instead at a church instead of going to
absolutely
going trick or treating, which yeah, there's a kind of a morality police woman that moves to town and tries to get Halloween banned, and Hank is furious and puts on his boyhood devil costume and walks through the street with his gut hanging out and these short shorts on, going trick or treat, and just like pronouncing it very, very Hank Hill. And it just kills me every time. And it's really kind of unlike later King of the Hill episodes, but it's really good. It's really fun. And while I guess I'll wrap up my King of the Hill mentions, but the episode Pygmalion, one of my favorite King of the Hill episodes.
That one is great.
This is some years later. This came out in 2003. And actually, this was not a Halloween episode, believe it or not, Donovan, which doesn't seem right, does it?
Really thought that was a Halloween episode.
Apparently, it first aired in January of 2003, which makes no sense. But to me, this is...
So, like... How would you be ready for that?
I don't know. You sit down, you think, oh, new year, this is great. 2003, this is going to be it. The Super Bowl's in a few weeks. Probably just got done watching some playoff football. And this is the most bizarre, troubling episode of animated television that I've ever seen.
It is like, you know, we're solidly in the midst of a PG rating here, which I think makes it much more unsettling, right? Like, there's nothing here that, like, on paper, you couldn't show, say, a 10-year-old. And yet...
Should you?
It haunts me. It haunts me to this day.
So, Blaine, the episode is that the Hill's niece, Luann, is smitten by this guy who owns a pork products factory. And slowly, she's invited to live at this giant mansion that he owns. And he starts dressing her as like this German milkmaid kind of outfit and like dyeing her hair. And he's trying to recreate, you find out, the original logo. He was in love with the logo of the pork products line. Is this right, Donovan? Does this sound right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a calendar that was hanging in his room, and he's she looks like the girl in this calendar. He's found someone who looks like the man, and he wants to be the pig.
He wants to be the pig, and that's his life's dream. And so at the end, big spoiler alert here for an animated show that came out 17 years ago, but he finds himself on the kill line at the pork products place. And, you know, they apparently, for animation reasons, they stun the pig first. So he goes through this electrical field, and his head is suddenly cleared. He said, "Oh my God, why am I wearing a pig costume?" And boom, that big.
What am I doing?
That big the kill, the pneumatic. What would you call that thing? The No Country for Old Men killer.
Yeah, it's like the No Country for Old Men pneumatic.
Yeah, yeah. It gets him. It kills him. Trip is killed at the end of the episode. It is so bizarre.
Did we mention that Trip is voiced by Michael Keaton?
Good point. Good point.
That feels germane to all of this as well.
Anyway, that's wow. It's an odd 30 minutes of television,
leading to an oft-repeated line. Life is a series of compromises.
The greatest King of the Hill line. They ask the guy that's playing the Luann's husband from the calendar, quote unquote. They said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "Oh, life is a series of compromises." That and a few Homer lines, that's all the wisdom you need to know in life.
Absolutely.
That and trying is the first step towards failure. You're good to go.
So where are we? Donovan, have you brought up
Can I make plugs for, because I rewatch them probably every Halloween.
Really?
The Treehouse of Horror episode 4 and 5.
So are those two the best?
Those are my favorites. There's other bits that have my favorite, that have favorite pieces in them, but those ones have my favorite just back-to-back bits, because it's got, and I think I was rewatching them for this, and I think they're doing, you know, they're doing Simpsons jokes in Halloween episodes, right? They're doing like, you know, they do Terror, what is it, Terror 20,000 Feet, but on the school bus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Principal Skinner's on the bus, and there's just a line where he's like, "Oh, hello, Bart. You know, Mother took away my keys for talking to a woman on the phone. She was right to do it. It could be in any episode. It just happens to be in the Halloween episode.
Right,
you know.
Right.
And, wait, was that the principal or was that Mike Pence?
Mother.
Yeah. Yes. You know, they're back to back my favorite ones. I really, you know, the five has the shinning because, you know, they don't want to get sued, leading to the I think it's a great. I think it's a great line where, you know, Homer's written no TV and beer make Homer go something, you know, make Homer go something, something. And Marge goes crazy. Don't mind if I do. It's just great. It's just great. Great stuff. It's also weird to realize how much of these Simpsons episodes are Twilight Zone takeoff, specifically ones written by Richard Matheson. He's like a one man. There's one where like the Krusty doll comes to life and tries to kill Bart. That's a Richard Matheson episode. You know, and they're all, I think they do a Sound of Thunder, the Ray Bradbury bit. So it's all fun. Those are stone cold classics back to back.
You stopped one short of my favorite Treehouse of Horror. Mine is from it's the sixth edition of Treehouse of Horror, the seventh season. Overall, the one that has Nightmare on Evergreen Terrace and Homer cubed, I love that episode.
That's number six, Treehouse 6. That's your favorite?
Yeah, Treehouse.
Your favorite one?
Treehouse 6 is definitely my favorite, with the Nightmare on Evergreen Terrace and the Homer cubed bit,
those are also good ones.
It's just a classic. And it came out in 95, and like the weird Homer in that bizarro land thing is just so good.
I feel like that's another takeoff on a Twilight Zone episode.
I'm sure it is,
because I'm also a fan of the individual one where Kang and Kodos turn into, you know, Bill Clinton and Bob Dole for the election. You know, fewer abortions for some, more abortions for others. Yay!
So do you guys remember the episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Who Got Dee Pregnant?
That, yes. That is an absolute
an all-time classic.
This is the one where they all remember her differently, right? And they remember the night differently? Okay. And the bird is in the bathroom. Yeah. Okay.
It's their Rashomon episode, and it's great.
Yeah.
Dee tells them that she has gotten pregnant by one of them back during a Halloween party when they don't, you know, when they finally notice she's putting on weight, and she. So that's one of my favorite Halloween episodes. Any It's Always Sunny is a good episode. And Donovan, maybe you can comment on this one specifically. Your memory may be better than mine. Do you remember the Louie episode where it was like half Halloween episode?
I cannot remember. Louie's been memory hold for me like the rest of us, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose so. It seemed like it was a good one. I remember it being kind of freaky.
I know I've seen it, but it does not stand out for me. All gotcha. I can remember is David Lynch on Louie now. That's it.
Yeah, I remember that too. Stranger Things, I thought, kicked off their second season so well with capturing that 80s Halloween feel when they were all dressed as Ghostbusters. Yeah,
I guess if you like the costumes, right? That's a good one.
That is a good one.
I've always thought it was interesting and notable that Modern Family had its best episodes for Halloween every year.
That's a low bar to clear.
Yeah, it was. They got worse and worse as the years went on, but it was always fun to watch their Halloween episodes. And I always have gotten big kicks out of SNL's Halloween skits when they come around, even though they too have gotten worse with their writing, especially this year. But, you know,
this has been a rough year.
Yeah, it has. They still produced the David Pumpkin skit. That was the most recent one. That was fantastic.
You know, I don't know if it's funny anymore because, you know, we kind of watched over and over. But man, there's something about Tom Hanks just like totally willingness to commit to the joke that just makes that very strange sketch very good.
And am I misremembering this, but wasn't there a Halloween party skit on SNL that where Obama showed up in an Obama mask?
It's not ringing a bell. But they've done a lot of Halloween episodes.
So we go try. I think that's accurate where Obama shows up in an Obama mask and he pulls it off and it's really him.
And it's actually him.
I think that, yeah, look that up. It's pretty good. What other Halloween episodes that stick with you?
I've always been a fan of Bob's Burgers Halloween episodes.
I think they're so good.
My favorite one is the one where they all get trapped in the fort. Mostly, I love the bit where the twins die. And one of them is like, "You I felt you die. I know."
Ollie and Andy are two of the characters. They're kind of like, if you rewatch Parks and Rec, Jeremy Jam gets funnier and funnier. Ollie and Andy are that character in Bob's Burgers. The fort one is so, I just watched that one within the last 3 days, probably. That one's good. All of them, really. I mean, where they go to the rich island or the rich neighborhood or whatever.
That one's good, especially as they do the, right, they're doing like the Warriors thing, right? As they're trying to get at like the kids are calling like, "Come out to play," because they're going to prank them and they have to get back to, you know, the dock the ferry, in time to get home. Yeah, the ferry, yeah. So they're doing the Warriors.
Another one that feels Halloween adjacent, I don't think it is the, because Bob's Burgers is unafraid to blatantly do Halloween, but the episode where they kind of spin off the Goonies, that wasn't like a straight up Halloween one, right?
That's a solid one. I think that was like first or second episode. They've actually had,
it was pretty early on.
They've had some Christmas episodes that feel closer to Halloween, like the one with the guy who's in love with the mannequin.
A bizarre one, yeah.
That one is, but maybe they have the spirit of Halloween at all times.
I think they seem to. That's a show that's just perfectly, because it's already doing that like childhood wonder combined with adult malaise, but like everybody generally likes each other kind of thing so well. And they're somewhere on the Eastern Seaboard, so it's just like primed for good autumn content.
They absolutely live in like Massachusetts or Rhode Island. Like there's somebody I met, like I thought like Teddy, you know, like Teddy in the show. I met someone with his accent and I was like, "Oh my god. That's an accent." I didn't realize that was it. And like the president of my union when I was at UConn sounds like Bob. Like he's got the same cadence and only he does it with like child labor. This is what we had before unions. So it's a different Kennedy accent.
That's not impossible.
Well, that was my bad approximation.
Fantastic show. I think maybe my last one that I'll touch on, a show that had maybe a different angle on Halloween, and I just want to always bring the show up if I can. Parks and Rec, the Greg Pakaitis episode.
Greg Pakaitis.
For a character that is so, I hate that character so much, and he was only on that show twice. That's quite an achievement. They Greg created Pakaitis. Just the ultimate little shit.
The ultimate monster.
Yeah.
Those are a list of great ones. And Donovan briefly mentioned it, but I'll reiterate. If you just want to watch some good creepy stuff, those old Twilight Zone episodes are on Netflix and Hulu,
fantastic.
I think. You can't go wrong with those. All right. Just a big thanks to everyone who listens. We'll be back with you next Tuesday with a new episode. And I think that's when we're going to do our segment for the very first book club episode, which is going to feature The Only Good Indians. And we may touch on American Utopia from HBO. That seems to be the direction we're leaning. So get with us next week. We'll talk a book and we'll talk the HBO movie American Utopia. And talk to you then.